You are listening to Sid Weighs In, where Tuck School business professor, associate dean for executive education, and an expert on strategy and leadership, Sidney Finkelstein, shares his views on what leaders are doing, why they are doing it, and whether it makes sense for them and for you.
This is Sidney Finkelstein from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, and welcome to another edition of Sid Weighs In, the podcast where I talk about one of my recent BBC columns. And today we have as our guest host, once again, Nell Ryder.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good.
Tell us a little bit about your background, Nell.
So I'm in my second year here at Tuck. Very, very sad to be graduating next month.
And sad to be graduating?
So sad.
They're not saying that in our competitors, though, are they? They're happy to be graduating.
They're probably so happy, but they don't live in the middle of the woods on the Connecticut River. Yeah. And it just got warm out. So just very briefly about myself, I graduated from college in 2009, had a very brief career in stand-up comedy before I wisened up and took a role in marketing consulting, which I did for 2.5 years before coming to Tuck.
Well, that's good to hear, Nell. Different background, but one where you're taking the straight and narrow, so that's kind of interesting. I'm sure it'll be pretty dynamic. I would think in marketing and marketing consulting and when you're dealing with customers, something called curiosity would be pretty important, which, of course, is one of the themes of the column that we're going to talk about. I'm talking about in the context of boards of directors, but I'm curious I'm curious about your view on curiosity and whether that skill set, if you will, whatever you want to call it, has played a role in what you've observed, what you've seen, certainly what you experienced at Tuck in your time here.
Yeah, definitely. So I was visiting my best friend this past weekend. He goes to law school down at Vanderbilt. And I was sitting with a bunch of law students, and they started, like, basically making fun of the entire premise of business school and saying that it's just, like, all about networking and our GPA requirements are lower for top-tier business schools than they are for top-tier law schools, which is completely true. And that it's just, you know, an opportunity to meet people and party. And I hear that all the time, and I really don't know how to, you know, defend the skills of my classmates when people level such accusations. But as I was reading this article and just thinking about, you know, the import of curiosity, I do think that business schools place almost an obsessive emphasis on being, quote unquote, well-rounded, whatever that means. And I think being well-rounded and being curious are essentially the same thing. And so the idea, you know, that Tuck students or MBA students don't have 3.9 GPAs like they do at law school, I think is actually a good thing. And business schools value that because the idea is, you know, you have to be good at a lot of different things. You kind of need to be an all-star athlete. And I think there's tremendous value in being well-rounded and being curious because it brings such a variety of perspective that gives you flexibility to adapt to a lot of different situations, whereas maybe the people I was talking to in law school don't have that flexibility. So I do think curiosity is a very unique trait to most MBA students that I've definitely observed at Tuck.
Well, I've got a lot I could say in response to in response to that, including the little point about people that feel the need to denigrate others' careers, other people, other passions to elevate themselves. It says more about them than it does about you or us. But maybe more important, and then I'll get into the column. The purpose of business school is absolutely essential to society. There is nothing you can do in the world if you don't have the skills that you learn or get enhanced in a business school. And that's around innovation. It's about leadership. It's about thinking strategically. It's about managing teams, managing people, learning how to deal with change. There's nothing in the world that needs to get done for which those skills are not essential. And so there.
Yeah, take that.
So I'm going to talk about courage and curiosity, and do that in the context of corporate boards of directors, where it seems to be sadly lacking. And so this column is whatever happened to curiosity and courage. In a room full of smart and accomplished corporate board directors and CEOs from leading companies around the world, one topic resonated above all the usual items on the table. It wasn't strategy, risk management, or compensation that stood out among the group I spent a couple of days with last week. It was courage. Of course, that wasn't the word they used to describe their dilemma. It only became apparent that courage was an issue when I asked the executives what they do when there's something that comes up in a board meeting they don't quite understand. It could be about technology, a competitor, a proposed acquisition, anything. So what do these smart, accomplished corporate directors do when something doesn't make sense to them? Well, nothing. There are exceptions, of course, but most directors tend to assume that if they don't understand the logic of a CEO's argument or strategy, they're probably the only one. Rather than be singled out, these people, who are the last line of defense for shareholders intent on reining in out-of-control management teams, they shy away from asking the question they really want to ask. For super successful big ego types that populate many public boards, acknowledging to your peers that you don't understand something can be profoundly embarrassing. Better to play along. Maybe hope someone else will give voice to your concern and not call attention to what you don't know. It's the opposite of how a child behaves, isn't it? When young people don't understand, they usually ask why. They feel no shame in not knowing. Instead, they just want to understand better. Somewhere along the way, all of us lose some of that natural inquisitiveness. We become more guarded, self-protecting, even calculating. It's a natural process, to be sure, but what happens when that innocent curiosity is lost and your job is protecting shareholder interests as a board of directors? Answer, you get the dismal state of affairs that exists in many companies around the world, where effective oversight often takes a back seat to keeping your mouth shut and getting along. For example, how did the board of Hewlett-Packard stumble through multiple CEOs before finally settling on Meg Whitman, losing billions of dollars in bad acquisitions and lost market share along the way? When most acquisitions fail to create shareholder value, why do boards continue to approve deals their CEOs want? For example, Boston Scientific buying Guidant at an exorbitant price, leading to $4.5 billion in losses in the subsequent three-year time period, or Microsoft's deal for the weakest part of Nokia in the face of the collapse of Nokia's mobile phone business under the onslaught of Apple and Samsung. The Canadian telecommunications giant Nortel is a classic case study in board failure. Once a leading company mentioned the same sentence as Cisco, Intel, and IBM, after all, Nortel built the world's fastest optical networks. Nortel's board approved a disastrous series of acquisitions headlined by Bay Networks in the late 1990s that almost bankrupted the firm. When the board finally did flex its muscles, it gave blanket acceptance to the faulty recommendations of board-sanctioned investigators. That led to an executive house cleaning at the very moment the company most needed that talent to lead the turnaround. If we were to write a job description for board director, would we include, quote, uncritical acceptance of others' views, end quote, in the short list of capabilities? I've seen firsthand the price that shareholders, employees, and communities pay when boards lack curiosity and courage. For instance, as an expert witness in one of the Enron trials, I got access to confidential documents that have been presented by management at board meetings. The Houston, Texas-based energy giant's top executives ended up in prison. The company collapsed, the stock tanked, and employees were out of jobs and often had their retirement savings largely wiped out. But out of that morass of documents, there's only one sequence of events that stood out. Each quarter, the board would be given a pie chart that summarized the percentage of Enron's assets that were performing above expectations, meeting expectations, below expectations, or were troubled. Quarter by quarter, the board would see, as I did, how the percentage of assets performing at or above expectations declined, while assets in the troubled category increased. Then, after five quarters, the report stopped. I searched far and wide for any document indicating the board received this information in successive quarters, but it wasn't to be found. The reports had just stopped. Now, it doesn't take an expert in corporate governance to wonder why the report was no more. Arguably, a small child might have been curious about that, and in consequence, what was happening to those assets. After all, the corporate directors had fiduciary responsibility over them. There was no evidence in the board minutes or anywhere else that the board became alarmed at this deterioration. We all know how the story ended. The largest bankruptcy in American history at that time. A quick look at the largest bankruptcies of all time reveals a similar story. Boards of directors at Lehman Brothers, which was the largest, Washington Mutual, second largest, WorldCom, third, and GM, fourth, all had opportunities to challenge what could have been deemed corrupt and certainly high-risk practices at each of these companies, ranging from excessive bets on subprime mortgages to continually misreading market trends. In light of recent revelations in how General Motors allegedly disregarded ignition switch problems that led to at least 13 deaths in car accidents, it's clear that deficits in courage and curiosity did not disappear after that company's bankruptcy reorganization. The system of corporate governance that exists in most countries in the world, and especially in Western economies, is the backbone of capitalism. Without appropriate oversight by an independent group of experts with fiduciary responsibility to protect shareholder interests, the entire system breaks down. Small investors begin to feel like the system is rigged against them. Unfortunately, despite the theory of how boards are supposed to work, the reality is considerably messier. Reinvigorating boards with curiosity and courage would be a very good place to start fixing what's broken.
So I guess my reaction to this is that the issue is less, you know, courage or a lack of courage than it is culture. And I think the perspective that I read it with was one of age, which probably isn't like the most salient theme in this piece, but basically I was putting myself and my peers in the position of a corporate board, because that's the only way I know how to understand things. And I think that there is a fundamental difference with my generation and the generation of your typical corporate board member in that, A, we are very, very pleased with ourselves all the time, and we feel very, very good about speaking up about every possible point, even if it is completely nonsensical. And B, I don't think we have the kind of, you know, adherence to privacy or putting your head down and shutting up that you might see with someone a bit older who is part of a corporate board. And, you know, maybe to some degree that's the business world that they grew up in, you know, the 70s, 80s, I guess that makes sense time-wise. And yeah, that it's just like a totally different paradigm, and culture does play a huge role, both at the individual level, but also when you get a group of individuals together, clearly at the corporate level. And so, you know, just for me, I think about what PepsiCo, for example, is going to be like when it's run by a bunch of board members who grew up in the world that I grew up in. And I envision, you know, it's kind of a hilarious scene where everyone has really important points that probably aren't that important, that they really desperately want to be heard, and no one is shutting up and nothing is getting done because everyone is challenging everyone on a given idea or decision. And I just think it's going to be vastly different. That didn't resonate with me at all, I guess, is my reaction.
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about. Will this be will this be kind of an age thing, as you say, that, you know, you're growing up in a different generation with social media and you know, people sharing all kinds of things about themselves and always speaking up. And so when you get to, you know, the age of 45, 55, 65 on boards of directors, you're going to keep on going. Or, which is, you know, a nice thing to think about, and a less attractive thing to think about is that it gets beaten out of you over time.
Yeah.
Because the higher up you go and the more successful you are, the more you have to lose by rocking the boat.
Yeah. No, I do think that's a good point. I also, something we were talking about earlier is this idea of, again, to the point of culture, if you want to promote a culture of collaboration and cohesion, to what degree does being that outlier or that whistleblower or the one person who's standing up and saying, hey, I don't think that's a good idea and here's why, to what degree is that actually helpful? I mean, obviously, where there's a terrible decision about to be made, like Enron, the more whistleblowers, the better. But if every individual, every single decision is questioned and re-questioned and explored, and people always are poking holes in something, you know, I do think that definitely has the potential to undermine any culture, any sense of cohesion, any team. So, you know, there's definitely something to be said about striking that fine balance. And who knows, maybe we'll wisen up and maybe bring some of our self-importance to the table and not lose that sense of participation and speaking up while simultaneously understanding that, you know, not everything requires that our voice be heard. And you could tell that to some of my classmates, too.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thought, because that's kind of the pushback that I've gotten once the article, the column was published, which is, look, you know, we're a little different, and you don't want to, you want to support the CEO. You don't want to be seen as not supporting the CEO. You want to be seen as a team player. And if you raise your hand and point out, you know, what's wrong, you lose some of that. And I get that, of course, and I think that's part of it. But I think you end up, the odds are you're going to end up hurting yourself much more than helping yourself if you allow that kind of getting along culture to dominate over saying what you really think. It's a bit of a broader question, too, about honesty, which I'm sure I'll be writing about in subsequent columns. You know, we live in a world where people are not very honest. And I don't mean in an illegal or even unethical way. I mean in everyday life. Do we really say what we're thinking? And if everyone said what they're thinking in an unvarnished way, we probably have a lot of fights going on, a lot of chaos. So we have to be able to kind of manage ourselves and self-monitor. But maybe we do so much of that that we kind of create these fantasy worlds in, in companies where you know you disagree. You know everybody's talking about this at the famous water cooler, and nobody's saying anything.
Yeah. No, so I'm thinking about two classes that I'm taking currently. One is called Managing Business Relationships, which is basically talking about how to lead individuals at the C-suite level. It's putting all of us in the position of CEO. And my one big takeaway for the class, and it's based on a study that I think the professor conducted, was basically that every CEO is direct. So if there's a problem, you know, whether it's an issue of not having enough time or just that's the nature of their personality, CEOs don't typically beat around the bush. And so his whole point was, you know, we did a simulation and everyone played a part in some, you know, fake, fictitious business case. And everyone was super confrontation averse. We're all friends with each other, so no one wanted to get to the heart of the matter. But the takeaway from the class was you're all confrontation averse right now because no one likes confrontation. But 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, if you are to be a successful CEO, you're going to have to learn to develop those skills where you can sit comfortably with confrontation and be open about ideas that you really care about. But then the flip side of that is my negotiations class, which is basically don't ever tell anybody what you have, ever, period. So, you know, there's definitely, it's all about, I guess, striking the right balance between being upfront and being open, but then also, you know, putting your head down. And I would like to think that hopefully my generation, because we are just like bursting out the gates onto the business world right now with this just huge and vocal sense of self-importance and openness, you know, hopefully that gets tempered quite a bit. But, you know, maybe we keep some of it 20 years down the road that when we're sitting on corporate boards, you know, we don't have that confrontation aversion. Who knows?
You know,
it'll be interesting.
The irony is that this strength from a CEO or any successful leader saying what you're thinking and being direct, somehow you get on a board of directors and all of a sudden you stop doing that. And everyone kind of has this secret handshake that says we're going to stop kind of being ourselves and we're all going to get along and not kind of confront the CEO on the board. And the net result is these crazy acquisitions and a lot of bad deals that end up happening and very weak corporate governance at the end of the day. Well, Nell, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great discussion, and we'll see everybody next time.
This has been Sid Wazin. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, follow Professor Finkelstein on Twitter @SidFinkelstein, #SidWazin. Thank you for listening.